Members, we're going to get started. We have 1, 2, 3, 4 bills, and we're actually a little bit hopeful that we could probably maybe get through them this morning. If not, we'll be back here this evening to finish them. And so if we can start right away, the better. We don't have minutes before us to move today. I'm going to ask our vice chair to chair for a minute while we do House File 925.
Representative Mariani, what is your motion regarding this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to have House File number 925 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Okay, so we have before us House File 925. Representative Mariani has moved that it be passed and sent to the General Register. Did you speak to your bill?
Madam Chair, members, pretty simple bill having to do with management assistance to the school, clarifying to school districts, clarifying language. Representative Erickson, I think you've probably seen these kind of bills over time, and my hope is that it's not controversial and we can have this passed out in short order.
Are there any questions, members? If not, Representative Mariani renews his motion that House File 925 be passed and sent to the General Register. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're quite efficient. I should just
yes.
leave you there.
On difficult bills, yes.
Madam Chair, can we keep you in place if we're going to move this quickly?
Well, thank you, Representative Kreshaw.
I'll second that.
I like that idea.
I think we have a motion to move the chair.
this is how coup d'etat is. Yeah, I think I lose all my votes on this side, too. All right. So let me get my.
So, Mr. Chair, we did have a quorum when we passed that?
Actually, did we have a quorum?
I mean, I'm just double checking. Did we? Did we not? Yes. Thank you.
And 11. Thank you, Representative Erickson. That would have been a real problem.
Well, we don't want to do it again.
No.
My arrival timely?
So,
I was the committee.
Representative Dabney, House File 771, and you have a motion before us.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. First of all, I'd like to move House File 771 be recommended pass and then straight to the Register, if I recall correctly, or are we going to finance? Mr. Grascombe?
Laid over.
We can do that too. So I'd like to move House File 771 be before the committee for possible inclusion in a omnibus bill.
Very well. Representative Dabney moves House File 771 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus policy bill.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the H771A1 amendment. This amendment for members. The bill as drafted sets a four-year sunset on the use of restrictive procedures. In the bill, this by deleting, or excuse me, well, by amending page 5, line 11, the use of prone restraints, excuse me, not restrictive procedures, but this is specifically prone restraints, reduces that sunset to 2 years from now, 2015. And the second part of the amendment is just some comfort language that assures that highly qualified paraprofessionals are also trained in proper use of restraint procedures to assure the safety of both students and staff in those situations. And I'd ask for support.
Representative Dabney, it sounds like this puts the bill in the shape you want.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
This amendment puts the bill in the shape you want it before us. Members, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
I'm sorry, Representative, you're correct. Representative Erickson. Members, discussion.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Representative Daphne, are you suggesting in your amendment that we do not already have highly qualified paraprofessionals trained to work in this area?
Representative Daphne.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, not at all. This was some comfort language that was requested to assure, since paraprofessionals often are drawn in an emergency situation, which is, as you know, the only time prone restraint is allowed is in an emergency situation, that assurance that those who are drawn in have, in fact, been trained. And I believe the highly qualified is a term of art from No Child Left Behind.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you for your question.
Okay. It's been clarified by Ms. Larson. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erickson, for slowing properly slowing our discussion down. Any other comments, discussions, questions on the A1 amendment? If not, all in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Daphne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is, I believe, the third year in a row that I have been back with legislation dealing with the issues of restrictive procedures and prone restraints in schools. Each year it is an attempt, and House File 771 is this year's attempt, to further clarify and reduce the use of these procedures in schools. The Department of Education has been collecting data these last few years, and I believe they can demonstrate that, in fact, schools are using these procedures in fewer and fewer settings. I think it's also, however, fair to say that while a goal of eliminating them is the right goal, we are not at a place now, due to the behavior of some students in limited settings who can be a threat to either themselves or others at times, that we can simply eliminate them. Across the country, I know we have looked into this, and many states have similar statutes to Minnesota's where it establishes the goal of eliminating prohibiting the use of particularly prone restraints. But it does continue to allow them in limited situations. House File 771, further clarifies some of the language, tightens the requirements for IEP review after the use of these approaches, and then again sunsets now in 2 years the use of prone restraints to force us to come back, be accountable, be transparent, and review the uses of prone restraint in particular before we continue that conversation. With me today, Mr. Chair and members, is Superintendent Hayes, who was before the committee yesterday. So she gets frequent flyer miles for her appearance here today.
Welcome to the committee, Superintendent Hayes. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Connie Hayes. I'm superintendent at Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District. I'm here to testify in support of the bill, including continued use of prone restraint. I was a participant on the restrictive procedure work group facilitated by the Department of Education, and I want to thank the department for their skillful leadership with the discussion around a sensitive issue. As educators and advocates around the table, it was not hard to agree on our common vision. We want all kids to do so well in school that the need for restrictive procedures are not necessary. Our differences were grounded in our different experiences. We shared our experience with each other, and I feel we have all have a much better understanding of how our experiences shape the positions we take to the use of restrictive procedures, including prone restraint. That common understanding, I believe, is a positive foundation we all felt we can build upon to continue our work towards our vision together. And we want to continue meeting, so I think that's obviously a very good sign of the positive work that we have. At the intermediate school districts, our experience was in part verified yesterday in the OLA report on the cost of special education. Some data in the study showed a decrease in the numbers of students served in residential facilities. Those students have not gone away. Those students who have the highest and greatest level of needs and who often exhibit violent behaviors are showing up in larger numbers at the intermediate school districts and other regional education centers around the state. Some experts will say the reason fewer students are being served in residential placements is because they do not show good long-term success. I don't disagree with that. Yet nothing was done to prepare public school programs like ours for this change in policy. We've been responding by investing more and more resources in training our staff how to manage these oftentimes explosive behaviors. Training. It has become one of the cornerstones of our program. Learning how to identify, if they exist, the triggers to the behaviors, and then learning skills and de-escalation is absolutely essential. Whereas before, our staff might have put hands on a student making a significant threat, oftentimes now they hold back and use the strategies they have learned, and often the behavior de-escalates. Our staff has to be certified to use restrictive procedures, including prone restraint, and then they have to be recertified every year. This ensures that when an emergency is underway where others are at risk of serious harm or the student is at risk of seriously harming him or herself, they use prone restraint safely. With this kind of commitment to training, no student has ever been injured in prone restraint in our district. No staff have been injured in the use of prone restraint. We are committed to using prone only when necessary. That commitment, however, means that our staff is using other, less restrictive procedures up to the point of initiating a prone. It is that time period during the escalation phase where our staff are experiencing a very high rate of injury. Our workers' compensation program tells the story. In the field of workers' comp, there is something called a MOD factor. If your organization shows an injury rate which is average for your industry, your MOD factor is 1. Less than 1, you're doing great and your renewal rates are going to be good. Our MOD factor is 1.7. That means our injury rate is 70% greater than other public schools. We've come to believe that injuries are simply just a part of our new work environment. Our work group helped MDE develop their recently released report to the legislature to reduce the use of restrictive procedures. Some of the recommendations in that report are consistent with the many bills being considered this year in the area of children's mental health. But we have a lot of work ahead of us to put better supports in place so that fewer children and youth will be experiencing such extremes in behavior that need these kinds of interventions. We need to keep students and staff safe until our common vision can be realized. We need to make sure policy development and resource allocation catches up with the shift in serving fewer of these high-need students in residential facilities and more of them in public school programs like ours. Speaking for the three intermediate school districts and other regional special education centers around the state, I urge your support for this bill, including the additional time that would allow our highly trained staff to use prone restraint in emergency situations. I have with me here today our Director of Special Education, and I thought it would be helpful to the committee if you could hear a couple of examples, descriptions of challenging behaviors that we experience, and a description that differentiates when we use prone restraint and when we don't use prone restraint.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Superintendent Hayes. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Dan Naditz. I am the Director of Special Education for the Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District. I was a member of the work group that met this fall to help revise the bill and create the state plan to reduce restrictive procedures. I'd like to recognize the Minnesota Department of Education for the leadership and work in convening this group. It was a well-thought-out process that provided an opportunity for people on both sides of this issue to hear and understand the other's position. We all agreed at the beginning of the process that we can only create change when we work together. It seems that the use of prone restraint is a center point of disagreement within this bill. I wanted to share a couple examples to create the context for the use and the non-use of prone restraint. The first example is a 16-year-old that was referred to us due to continuous and severe property damage in his program in his resident district. This was a student, is a student with autism and has limited verbal skills. He was destroying walls and eating sheetrock. He was physically aggressive towards others and has a severe obsessive-compulsive disorder. Interventions that we implemented included creating a separate space that didn't have any drywall, one-to-one instruction, all visual schedule and visual learning, and a positive behavior management plan with frequent communication with his home and group home. These interventions were very successful, and after a few months, the student was able to transition into a classroom within our program with six other students, and he was generally successful in all areas of our program. Despite this success, there was an incident where the student was being transported alone in a van and became extremely agitated and upset. It is not known what the trigger was for this behavior, but the student proceeded to rip the seats and the interior of the van apart. The police needed to be called, and he was transported to the hospital. If this had occurred in our school setting, it may have required a restrictive procedure and possibly a prone restraint. It is impossible to predict when a prone restraint will be needed in response to an emergency situation. This is an example that even very aggressive and even dangerous students don't always need restrictive procedures to be safe and successful. The team was able to maintain safety for the student and staff through good interventions. However, they knew that they had the ability to use an emergency procedure, including prone restraint, that would keep the student and staff safe. There are very few students that require prone restraint as an emergency procedure, and there are even a fewer number of cases where we already know that a different type of emergency procedure cannot be used and does not work to keep the student safe. I have an example of such a situation where a prone restraint was needed due to the inability and the use of other emergency procedures weren't effective. In this incident, the student demonstrated self-harmful behaviors that included head-banging. The student was given a directive to begin working. He began escalating his behavior by throwing objects and tipping over the desk. This led to a series of proactive interventions that were unsuccessful. The student became physically aggressive towards staff by kicking, punching, and required an emergency intervention at that point. Seclusion was not an option because the student continued or would continue to bang his head when placed in seclusion. The use of vertical restraint was unsuccessful due to the size and strength of the student. The only emergency method that kept the student safe and the staff safe was a prone restraint. Finally, I want to reiterate that prone restraint is not used as a preferred emergency procedure. It is only used to keep students and staff safe when other emergency procedures fail. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Naditz. Are there any questions for our testifiers? Okay, very well, thank you. Hover around, though, because questions may arise. Are there others in the audience that wish to testify on the bill? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sue Abderholden from NAMI, Minnesota. Sorry, just trying to sing kumbaya very soon. Just for a little background for folks who haven't kind of been through this bill before, we actually started this process back in 2008, bringing together the education and the mental health community to try to create a community census on the use of seclusion and restraints in the school. In 2009, we came up with a compromise bill that was that did pass, and we actually gave school districts 2 years to implement it, knowing that this was kind of a big change and people needed time for training. You know, when I first began my work on this, NAMI did, there was a lot of contention. There was, you know, there were people that were saying, well, but seclusion restraints actually change behavior, although there was no research to support that. And so, you know, there were people who didn't want this law to pass. I have to say that now I really feel that there is a totally different perspective on this issue, which is really great to see. NAMI actually did a survey of all the special ed directors through a researcher from Cura last spring, and what we saw is that there was actually a consensus exists that the law has resulted in schools being more proactive in their approach to working with students. The majority of schools who responded utilized some form of standardized training, and all of them maintained documentation of the training that had been completed. What they saw as the additional benefits of the legislation is that there were fewer overall restraints used, which of course we thought was great, much better communication with parents, again, which is wonderful, more utilization of positive behavior intervention supports, schooling to mental health, all of those things. And what people said is, you know what, this has been actually a good law. We have learned a lot through it, through the training that's been required. And so what you have before you today is really, again, another consensus building activity where we said, okay, what are some of the tweaks that are needed in the law? So you see that we did change some things, clarifying an emergency. People said that was a little loose. They wanted a little bit more clarification, both from the advocates and the school personnel. When do we hold those IEP team meetings? Trying to make sure that that was more clarified in the law. And then beefing up the local review teams. What we really heard from districts is those local review teams really help them look at, so when are we using the seclusion and restraints? Is it during passing time? Is it in the, because of lunch? Is it a particular teacher that maybe needs more training? When is it being done? And really looking at that data so that we're really having data-driven decisions, which of course is always a good thing. So NAMI really does support this. Again, I think it's just another step forward in a very sometimes difficult subject area. I think it's, you know, unusual sometimes in this, especially on an issue like this where you really have advocates and the special ed community coming together saying, no, we agree to this and we think it's a step forward. I want to make it clear that NAMI does not like the use of prone restraints. This is not something we would advocate at all. But we also think that banning them at this time, except in cases of emergency, is not the way to go. We want to make sure that schools have the resources and the training so that they don't have to use them, that they're using something else. If we were not to extend it another 2 years, what we're fearful of kids with a serious mental illness is that, one, schools can already use reasonable force, and then there's no reporting and no training or anything in that area, or these children will be referred to the criminal justice system, which, of course, is something we don't want as well. So I urge your support for the bill.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Adler-Holden, and members, especially for newer members here. I think it's pretty important testimony in terms of not just the issue, but also actually the process and how sometimes our process here may not come up with an immediate solution to an issue, but can put into play with the force of our with the force of law and the force of our scrutiny an encouragement to buy some time. Get stakeholders together, you know, get the kind of communities out to a point where they can come up with good agreements and good adjustments to some pretty difficult issues. And so I know I'm editorializing a bit here, but, you know, when I first got elected, I came with a pretty big baseball bat and I was swinging for the fences, and I have yet to hit one of those. But, you know, bunts and base hits work pretty well in baseball, Representative Merritt, and you get enough of those and you start scoring some runs.
Mr. Chair?
I hear a voice. Representative Depp?
We seem to be developing a metaphor.
I like it. Yeah. I like it. And it's bipartisan. That's all good.
I'm channeling Roberto Clemente here.
Very good.
I think we have some other testifiers.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Jody Manning, and I'm from Pacer Center, where I serve as the Parent Training and Information Center Coordinator and have served in that position or as an employee at Pacer Center for 9 years. I feel the need to start with a personal story, if I may. I was first introduced to restrictive procedures through my son. My son is currently in his late 20s, and he was diagnosed with ADHD, inattentive type, when he was 5 years old. when he was in second grade, he started to struggle in school, and so I begged for assistance in him and his school. And those pleas were unanswered. So he didn't get any assistance in school, and so we tried to help him as best we could. When he was in middle school, he was diagnosed with depression, unfortunately, and he was hospitalized during that year. When he was to return to school, the school contacted us when we left a message for them indicating that he would return, and the response was, he can't come back to this school. You can't go from a hospital setting back into a school. That would be unsafe. So he was referred to a day treatment program that was through, not in our home school district, but through an intermediate district, and I will say that that school is no longer operating. Our son was in that school for a couple of weeks and told us some stories that concerned us, but we wanted him to plug along because he was developing a pattern of failing in programs and schools and being removed from them. After a few weeks in school, I went to pick him up for an orthodontist appointment. And while I was waiting in the lobby, and keep in mind this building was not intended to be a school, so it was in an industrial park, and I was waiting in what was considered the lobby for about 10 minutes. And during my 10-minute visit, I observed a child being put in a locked timeout room. Now, when my husband and I toured the facility, we noticed that. Quite frankly, I thought it looked like a fish house. I didn't know what it was. It was a box in the school, and I witnessed a child get thrown into that box. Shortly thereafter, I witnessed a child also be thrown in a prone restraint. This is just in my 10 minutes at the school. These were not emergency situations that I saw. I never felt in fear, ever. It didn't appear as though the students did, and it didn't appear as though the staff did. In fact, I appeared to be the only person traumatized by what I witnessed. So I share that story with you as an introduction to my experiences with restrictive procedures. When I was picking my son up and he started to come out of the school, I said, "Buddy, go get everything and all of your things here and put them in your backpack. And I'll wait here for you." And when we left, I called my husband and I said, "He's not going back." And he said, "What do you mean? You're going out for lunch after the appointment?" And I said, no, he's not going back. I can't have him be there. He has depression, and I can't have him be subjected to that or witness that. So we made the drastic choice to remove our son from school, and I homeschooled him for 2 years until he could be healthy enough to return to school. I'm grateful to say he was healthy enough. He returned before he entered high school, and he graduated with a 3.7 GPA, and he's a successful story. He's a tax-paying citizen. He holds down a full-time job, and he's a part-time college student as well. Now, I must bring up a couple of things related to the task force. I also served on the task force. I was very proud to be involved with my colleagues. I think we made a lot of great strides. We made some huge improvements to the proposed legislation. And if you read the very comprehensive report from the Minnesota Department of Education, you might have noticed that I wrote a response to the report that was included in the report on behalf of ARC of Minnesota, the Autism Society of Minnesota, Minnesota Disability Law Center, and PACER Center, where we essentially said we continue to strongly oppose prone restraint as a behavioral intervention, and we believe it should be discontinued by state law. We went on to say we supported the stakeholders' other proposed legislative changes to reduce restrictive procedures and support funding towards that goal. I'd also like to say that PACER's board adamantly supports a ban on prone restraint, and there are three main reasons why we support that ban on prone restraint, so I want to briefly go over those with you. As some of you may be aware, on June 31st of 2009, U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan wrote a letter to school chiefs regarding policies related to restrictive procedures and prone restraint. And in that letter, he talked about some concerns about a May 2009 hearing with the Education and Labor Committee in the House of Representatives, U.S. House of Representatives, to examine, in his words, what he said was the abusive and potentially deadly misapplication of seclusion and restraint techniques in schools. Very strong words. He also said that he had some concerns about the testimony that was issued that same day by the Government Accountability Office on seclusion and restraints. The report was called Seclusion and Restraints, Selected Cases of Death and Abuse at Public and Private Schools, and treatment centers. He went on to encourage states to review their policies to ensure that students are safe and, if appropriate, revise those policies. The second reason that we support a ban on prone restraint is related to MEDO. It's sometimes referred to as the Jensen Agreement, and perhaps you're aware of it. In September of 2008, the Minnesota Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities issued a report after an in-depth investigation on the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options. It's a facility that was operated by the Minnesota Department of Education, referred to as MEDO, M-E-T-O. The Ombudsman found that MEDO was engaging in systemic use of restraints and seclusion on individuals with developmental disabilities. So our most vulnerable citizens that were institutionalized were being subjected to a great number of seclusions and restraints. In July of 2009, three former residents of MEDO and their parents brought a class action suit against the state of Minnesota and the Minnesota Department of Human Services. In June of 2011, the plaintiffs, on behalf of the class and the state, reached a comprehensive class action agreement, settlement agreement. Among those important provisions in that settlement is that the state and DHS shall immediately and permanently discontinue the use of prone restraint at DHS-licensed facilities. So Pacer would ask, why then would prone restraints be appropriate for children? The third reason why we're supporting a ban on prone restraint is because asphyxiation is a risk factor with prone restraints. Children have died as the result of prone restraints, and that concerns us. In closing, I just want to say that the PACER board strongly supports a ban on prone restraint, but we would agree to a compromise for two more years as long as funding is allocated for training on alternatives to prone restraint. One such alternative is positive behaviors and interventions and supports. That is research-based and appropriate for students where prone restraints are not research-based. Our only concern is that we hope that in this coming 2 years that no child dies in our state as they have in others. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bender. I'm going to ask, Ms. Manning, I apologize. I'm going to ask Ms. Bender to come forward. But before I do, and then please stick around because there's some questions. So I understand the concerns, but I want to be clear. With the adoption of the amendment here, does the bill at this point meet your expectations as you've testified here before us?
Yes.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Manning. Ms. Bender from, Jean Bender from ARC. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jean Bender. I'm a public policy volunteer and a board member of both the Autism Society of Minnesota and the ARC Minnesota, and I'm here today to represent the position of both organizations. I also served on the Restrictive Procedures and Prone Restraint Stakeholder Group, and I am the parent of an adult with multiple disabilities, including mental health diagnoses that have manifested in aggressive and injurious behaviors. Both the Autism Society of Minnesota and the ARC Minnesota believe that prone restraint should be discontinued because of documented incidents of serious injury and death that have occurred. I won't go into detail because I feel like Jody Manning has presented sufficient information. But having stated our concern, we also believe it's necessary to have funding to support specific reduction efforts for all forms of restraints and in seclusion, and particularly prone restraints. Because House File 771 provides this funding, we don't oppose the two-year extension of the continued use of prone restraint for emergencies until August 2015, as proposed in Representative Dabney's amendment. Further, we support and applaud the following specific components of this bill. Clarification for the definitions of emergency and restrictive procedures, to ensure that they are not used inappropriately as a form of punishment or discipline. In addition, the stipulation that physical holding and seclusion is not to be used as a form of discipline. Increasing the standards for schools' restrictive procedures plans to include describing how the school will implement a range of positive behavior strategies and provide links to mental health services, and quarterly reviews by the School Oversight Committee to examine restrictive procedures' use, especially the repeated use on individual children. Timelines for holding IEP meetings or taking additional actions when multiple uses of restrictive procedures are performed on a child. Additional staff training, including school-wide programs focused on positive behavior strategies. Additional consultation with experts to develop an effective plan if current interventions are ineffective. Continuation of the stakeholders group charged with making recommendations to the commissioner by March 1, 2014. Outlining specific and measurable goals for reducing the use of restrictive procedures. Improved data collection and the requirement that the Commissioner of Education submit a report to the state legislator on district's progress in reducing the use of restrictive procedures and recommendations how to further reduce these procedures and eliminate the use of prone restraints. And finally, the fiscal appropriation to support the above requirements. I want to sincerely thank Representative Davney and the Department of Education for their leadership on this issue, and I urge your support of this bill as amended.
Thank you, Ms. Bender. We have three questions. I want to get to those questions, and then I'd like to see if the department will come forward and testify as well, and then we'll get back to questions. Does it sound like a plan, Representative Davney?
That does sound like a
very
plan,
well.
Chair.
Representative Sandra Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Davney. We've been through this many times, so I applaud you for being ever so persevering on this issue, because it is such a an important issue, and yet I understand exactly what Ms. Manning is talking about when it is comes to, you know, protecting our children who may get in these situations. But I didn't have a question for you, just a handout that I'd like the pages to distribute and for you to receive first, Representative Davney, from one of my psychologists. And he just raises some questions about sections of the bill that perhaps you could take a look at with others. I mean, I don't expect these changes to occur here on the spot. Thank you very much. I'll be sure Representative Davney receives one first. But he raises some questions about the deletion of the serious property destruction statement. And then further on page 2, the definition of seclusion, and he rather expands on that. So just a comment, Mr. Chair, and thank you for letting me share this. But members, I would like you each to have a copy just so you can see what a psychologist and a board-certified behavior analyst and certified instructor for crisis intervention and prevention has stated. He could not be here today and wanted me to deliver this. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Roger Erickson.
Just a point of clarification. At what, and I should know this probably, but at what point do students age themselves out of the school setting and are kind of on their own?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think there's a couple of possible answers to that, and someone will correct me where I go wrong, but of course we have compulsory attendance law up until the age of 16 at this time. The chair has a bill to extend that to 18, but students who receive special education services can continue to receive services up until the age of 21. So there's a couple of answers. One question, two answers.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Solotsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am a special education teacher, and I'm actually out of compliance right now because I have been certified, and I need to be doing that this spring, but I'll have to do that over the summer so I can get in on my next.
But you can keep Representative Erickson in line if need be.
Uh-huh. I just want to make sure that, you know, people understand that to be trained, it is roughly or approximately 22 hours of training, and then every year we have to do a 7-year retraining yearly. And so, I mean, these procedures are quite extensive, and we take great care in being trained, and it's a lot of work. It's a good workout. You don't need to work out that day at the Y if you had to do it. In the school that I teach in, we have over 4,200 students, and I'm just visiting with my the person who trains us. Thank goodness for the technology of iPad. But and she says she is the one who trains us, and she happens to be an EBD teacher, which, again, it takes a lot of time out of her day to be training all of the paraprofessionals that we have, as well as the staff. But I'm asking her, what kind of numbers are we using these restraints? And it's not used much, and mostly it's in out of the buildings that we do have. There's probably two buildings that we use it at all. And so just it's in those cases. And she did want me to say this, that the terminology that they use is when they use these restraints, some people, it's continuous aggression, continuous self-aggression, and continuous high magnitude disruption to define a crisis.
Thank you, Representative Sawatzky. And I think it is important for us to pause and acknowledge the incredible amount of energy and commitment and training that many of our professionals and our working with our students are currently committing themselves to. And Representative Dabney, hopefully your bill will only add to the quality of that experience on behalf of our teachers. Representative Leidinger, and then we'll go on to testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the first time I've been exposed to this. I didn't realize we did this in schools. And to be honest, what popped through my mind as we were talking through this, I'm thinking, do we also waterboard too? You know, and I don't mean that flippantly. I mean, really, it's kind of horrific to think about that we do this in school. But I listen to the news, and you hear this happening all over the United States. I think just yesterday they talked about a 7-year-old putting handcuffs out in California. Anyway, my questions are this. What is the scope of this in our state? Do we have numbers, and how many times we do that? Could you let me know that? And then the second question is, when we do this, these restrictive procedures, I know this is temporary, but is this temporary as a prelude to then someone coming to pick up the child? Or is this something that then, you know, you wait until the school ends and then he's released? I'm trying to understand that.
Representative Leidinger, many years ago when I was first made aware of, you know, both the conditions, if you will, that arise in very difficult situations, and the practices, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, what's going on? So obviously for newer members who are not in classroom settings, you know, this is an eye-opening, reality. I think the good thing is that we have increasingly, both regulate it as well as encourage all sorts of stakeholders to continue to develop effective practices in this regard. And we've heard from several groups here already who have been heavily engaged in doing that. But to the question of, you know, the prevalence, Representative Dabney, in terms of, or Ms. Abderholder, what are we talking about in terms of occurrences, generally speaking?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Leidinger, a couple of things. I'm going to go a little broader than your initial question. But to it, the surprise that you expressed is understandable. Mm-hmm. One of my themes over my dozen years here is the need for we as legislators in the community more broadly to recognize all of the kids who are in Minnesota schools, because bluntly, some of the kids who are there today were not there when you and I were there. And that is, when we talk about this, the population targeted today in this bill, that's very much true. They simply were not in our schools when you and I were that age. I'm reading from the use of prone restraints in Minnesota schools, January 2012 through December of 2012. This is an MDE document where they say across the state, districts report 16,604 physical holds. That may not be prone restraint, physical holds. And 5,236 uses of seclusion for a total of 21,840 restrictive procedures during the 2011-2012 school year. Of 127,561 special education students in the state, restrictive procedures were used with 2,592 students, which is approximately 2% of the special education population. So we're talking a very small percentage of the special ed population, which of course is a statewide average, I want to say about 13% of the general student population, 13, 14, 15, somewhere in there. Physical holding was used with 2,318 students and seclusion was 790. The average number of physical, we can go on. In this report, there is a accounting by district for its use in traditional districts, cooperatives, and I think importantly, the intermediate districts across the, in the state.
Ms. Adderholt.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if I could just add, what's important to remember is that prior to this being implemented in 2011, we had no data, no standards, no requirements for training. We had nothing. Parents didn't have to be notified. And so what we have is really basically a brand new law that, you know, has only been implemented, you know, in our really, you know, 2 years. And we expected that not everyone would know what to do off the bat. So the training that's gone into this so that they can use alternatives, you know, you heard earlier testimony about we learned we can't put hands on when a kid is upset, and it's only in an emergency, which is a different approach than was taken before the law went into effect, because it could be used then just as a disciplinary measure, which we know is not effective. So I think that the more training we get, the more experience, the more schooling to mental health services we get, and, you know, the more school support personnel, we will see the use of these procedures going down, which is what we want. I would say that I have not yet met anyone who likes to use them, but I can give you even examples of families that are part of NAMI where their kids become really quite violent, and it's they're at a younger age where you can't really reason with them. You know, I can reason with a teenager and try to use de-escalation techniques. I don't know if you've ever tried de-escalation techniques with a 9-year-old. It's very, very difficult. They're not in control of their body. They're not in control of their emotions. You know, something's happening inside of them that they can't, you know, really explain to anyone. And sometimes we have to protect them from hurting themselves or other people. So it's nothing that anyone likes. I want to really put that out there. But we have taken some very big steps in Minnesota to try to reduce the use of them.
Members and Representative Leidinger, thank you for the question. It allowed us to back up a little bit and provide a big context of information, particularly given since we have new members here. However, members, my task is to keep us moving. We have two other bills here. We can certainly have many hours of testimony, and perhaps we'll do that after deadline if it's members' interest to learn more about this very complex, emotional, and highly technical at times area. Mr. Naditz, I think you wanted to say something, and then I'm going to move us along with the testimony, and I do have members that still have questions. Mr. Naditz, if you could be brief, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representatives. Just to add some context to sort of the reporting on prone restraints, oftentimes in our district, we report a restraint in one report. Within that report, there are incidents, and an incident is when we hold a student, physically hold them, and then when students are calm, we immediately release them. So there's not a situation where you're holding a calm student. So when they're calm enough, we release that hold. Then oftentimes they will become aggressive again, and we have to reapply the hold. Those are considered individual prone restraints. And although an incident might last 15 minutes, a report in time, oftentimes you can see in the report that many of the prone restraints are in duration of less than 1 minute. The majority of restraints are less than 1 minute because we release, and then if they begin to continuously aggress, we have to reapply the hold and then do that over and over. So the frequency of the incidents isn't really indicative of the number of reports. Like you said, it's a pretty technical area to try to describe.
Thank you for that clarification. Representative Danny, are there other testifiers? I thought maybe the department wanted to speak to this issue. Is that...
Mr. Chair, I see the Historical Society coming down, but I don't think that's with the intent of testifying.
My
understanding is that the department is comfortable with the language of the bill as amended at this time. I guess I would just like to take this opportunity to reinforce, particularly to Representative Leidinger, this is under state law only used in the case of emergencies. Ms. Manning referred to the Mato situation where it was being used in other settings. It was being used as a behavioral intervention, and they were using things like handcuffs. That is not what's allowed in schools.
Members, we have three questions. I'd like to get these three questions in. Representative Barrett, Bly, Wills, then I'd like for us to move on the bill. Having said that, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on the bill? If not, then Representative Barrett, followed by Representative Bly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the report online and just trying to understand a few things that Representative Leidinger mentioned. The fact is a lot of the kids are age 9, 10, 11, a pretty interesting age, obviously, because, as Ms. Abderholden said, you're not really in control of what you do to some extent related to other ages. And also 80% of the kids, at least in this one, are either diagnosed as autism spectrum or EBD, emotional behavioral. But then I'm looking and I'm seeing that a lot of incidents happening with quite a few number of kids, as you know, the 80-20 rule, I think, holds true here. What do you do in that situation? I mean, obviously, having seven multiple incidents with one or two children, it's obvious something's wrong there. So what's the alternative? What do you do? Because you can't keep having incidents and not being able to control the incident. What's the solution in that situation where we have a small number of kids who are obviously having a lot of issues that we need to deal with? How do we deal with it?
Representative Dabney, I also see Ms. Abderholden perhaps working her way to the testifying.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, you asked an excellent question. You've drilled down to the essence, really, of the data. These procedures involve a very small percentage of students, generally with some very specific diagnoses. I think one of the things you do is school-wide prevention strategies, and that's why we're not ending the use of prone restraint and seclusion techniques immediately. That's a goal, I think, that's broadly shared, but there's also a recognition that we have to keep everyone safe, and you need time to transition and figure out, not only transition the system, as is required here with the use of positive behavioral strategies professionals, but also figure out what's up with Bob and what are the triggers that set Bob off and how do we recognize those early in the day so that we can work with Bob to not get to that point of escalating. I think another piece, my House File 353, which was heard here several weeks ago, the school-linked mental health proposal. The new funding that's proposed in that and is proposed in the governor's budget, 25% of that new funding goes specifically to districts that have a high use of these techniques to provide them with additional mental health services to work with those various students who are the most challenged and the most challenging.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, if you could use the word Jim and not Bob, I would appreciate it. That was a joke.
Carlos? Can I use the word Carlos?
Very good. Another bipartisan
solution. I tried Roger earlier. So.
Very informal group. Representative Bly and then Representative Wills, and then we'll move on to Bill.
I'll try to be brief. This really isn't a question, but a comment. I worked some years ago in both mental health facilities and in an EBD level 5 program where I was trained and had to use these restraints on a rare occasion. I think one thing to keep in mind, too, that if you have a context, which I think this bill is trying to address, where these things are applied with good training and the idea that you're doing this only in emergency and only really to to protect both the student and the others in the area. You also have to recognize that not only is there, even though this is a small group of young people, there's tremendous variation in the behaviors and the causes and the everything that's behind it. And it's important that you work closely as a practitioner with parents, with facilities, and you have a sense of how this can be used. And that I think the bill also is trying to point that out, that we need to have training, have understanding. There's also tremendous variation in philosophies about how to deal with behaviors and understand behaviors, which complicate this issue and bringing it forward. And I guess I would applaud the author and the advocates for trying to have a bill that focuses very narrowly on this kind of procedure and yet still allows for emergency situations this to happen. So that's just my comment.
Thank you, Representative Bly. It certainly feels to me like the field, if you will, is really quickly emerging with some pretty important elements, many of which you spoke to, the intentional training, transparency, and involvement of parents and others in the public. I'm intrigued by the local review teams, for instance, you know, et cetera. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dabney, for bringing this bill forward, and I appreciate you working on trying to clarify how this would work in a way that's going to be safer for children and used appropriately. I just had a couple of comments and questions. First of all, I just wanted to share that I was a personal care attendant for 7 years. So I worked with a child with high-functioning autism who would have outbursts, and in order to protect him and us from any harm, we would have to do similar types of procedures. And so I've had firsthand experience, and I think it's really important to make sure that you're addressing the situation in a safe and calm manner and with procedures that are going to be protecting the child. So I appreciate this. And with that, I had a comment question, I guess, on the language on at the beginning of the bill, line 110, where, or 9 and 10, where you're striking the language where it says, or to prevent serious property damage. And just in my experience, I feel that language should be left in there. I think that they kind of go together when a child has an outburst and damage could happen to property or an individual. And I think if they're starting to destroy property, they could easily start to hurt themselves or someone else. And it can happen very quickly. So I just had a concern about taking that language out. And there's also some explanation on the handout that Representative Erickson had that gave some other examples. So I would appreciate you looking at that. And then also, I had a question on the second page. And that was lines 216 through 220, or 215 through 220, about the restrictive procedures plan. And it says here that it would be made publicly accessible on line 216, and then also on 220 where it refers to links. And just for clarification, I'm guessing that when you say links, you mean on a website.
Yeah.
So, Debbie.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wills, yes. And perhaps that language needs to be clarified. That's fair.
Representative Debbie probably does.
It's probably does. Yeah.
And then just a follow-up on that, if I may.
Yes, please, Representative Wills.
I would appreciate clarification in the language of, like, links on what website would be the school website. Mm-hmm. I think that would help the schools know how to implement that. And then also to ensure that it could be available in a paper form if needed, if families don't have access to a computer for one reason or another. Just a concern about making sure it is accessible.
Representative Dabney, in terms of exercising the chair's discretion, it sounds like there's a simple friendly amendment, oral amendment here. Is it your desire to entertain that, or work on that as the bill continues to move forward.
You know, Mr. Chair, I can't imagine objection from the advocates to clarifying language. If Ms. Larson, she's looks like she's probably already doing it.
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chair?
I represent that.
While Ms. Larson is crafting language, could Ms. Aberholden respond to the deletion on 1.9 or prevent serious property damage that both Representative Erickson and Representative Wills raised concerns about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this was discussed in the task force. It was probably one of the areas where we saw what would be the right kind of misinterpretation. So, you know, if a child is just throwing a book on the floor, that's not serious property damage. If they're even if they're throwing a pencil, that's not serious property damage. And we were seeing some kind of misinterpretation of serious property damage. What everyone kind of felt like who was in the room at that time was that if you were going to do serious property damage, you were most likely going to hurt yourself or someone else. Because if you're trying to pick up something big, you're going to, you know, and you're going to try to throw it, you're going to hurt somebody in that process. So people really kind of felt as part of that discussion that it was most likely covered under the other two areas. And I think, as anything, if we see, you know, that we take this out and we see that there are problems, we revisit it. But people felt like there was a lot of misinterpretation on that phrase alone. I hope that helps.
Very well. And I believe Representative Wills... I'm not sure if Ms. Larson shared something with you yet in regards to a possible oral amendment. The members saw, while they're looking at that, it is there is wisdom in policy committees, certainly, while they have an opportunity to make these kind of adjustments that we're... you know, there seems to be an indication of sort of the whole committee coming together to say there might be a better way to do this. I think that's an appropriate function of a policy committee as opposed to having a finance committee at some point deal with those for those kind of issues.
You know, Mr. Chair,
represent that
one of the things that has been noticeable to me about this issue is the nonpartisan efforts on it, and
indeed.
I want to both thank Representative Erickson for her kind words earlier, but also commend her. She was a leader when she chaired this committee in the past biennium on helping move previous legislation that I carried on this topic forward, and there are few enough times when we work, when the committee works as well bipartisanly as we're seeing here, and I want to commend Representative Wills for her diligence in actually reading the bill and thinking about it critically and coming up with you know, a very sincere and legitimate point that we can respond to, and thank the chair for his indulgence on the
both points properly noted. And you're correct, the history on this issue has been you know, strong nonpartisan approach to addressing these important safety issues and management issues in our schools for students. While they're working on that language, very quickly, I do want to acknowledge there's a couple of groups here before us. The Minnesota Historical Society has a group of ninth grade students from St. Louis Park here, and I think they're probably sitting over here. Is that correct? I wonder if you all can stand up, and we can welcome you to our committee. Awfully good to have you here. Thanks. Thank you for being here. Are you here all day? Are they here all day?
Till 1.
Oh, till 1. Okay. Well, good. And then we also have future teachers with us here today. Today is Minnesota Association for Colleges for Teacher Education, otherwise known as MACTE. Day, and there's a group of 20 future teachers who have taken time to learn about the legislative process, and hopefully they'll be visiting a number of us to share their stories and hopes and visions and concerns for public education and, well, for all education in the state of Minnesota. So if you can please stand to be acknowledged and welcome. So, members, there we have it. Our secondary and our post-secondary future leaders of Minnesota. Representative Wells.
Still working it out.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Ernst.
I wonder if we shouldn't lay this over and maybe address it tonight when we return and they can get the issues worked out so that we're not...
We are certainly going to come back this evening.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Abney.
I appreciate the problem solving. My only concern is making the advocates come back again this evening. Is it possible as an alternative to take one of the remaining two bills, lay this over at this time, take up one of the remaining two bills, and then come back to this bill still in the morning session?
We could certainly do that. We have about 20 minutes left in this session. So why don't we lay this bill over? And in the meantime, we'll begin our testimony on House File 363, Benson. And Representative Benson moves that House File 363 be recommended to pass and referred to the K-12 Finance Committee. Is that correct, Representative Benson?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Benson, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, I also have a delete all.
Representative Benson.
A130116.
Hold on a second. Representative Benson moves adoption of the... A130116, is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Amendment, and Representative Benson, I take it this is to put the bill in the shape that the author wishes it to be before us. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, this is not in regard to the amendment, just to the process. This came to us as a delete-all after, of course, we had reached the deadline to submit our two amendments. Which I will not be offering now because they do not match up. But I think we need to work out a better process when this occurs so that perhaps we're given a waiver or some opportunity to then amend. I mean, I know we could handwrite them out, but I don't think that's appropriate. So just that statement, and we'd like, you know, some discussion about that at a point.
Mr. Chairman.
And, Mr. Chair, that discussion can be offline.
Representative Benson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of the other two amendments, but I do believe... Unless I'm mistaken, my delete all was introduced within the 24-hour rule.
Representative Benson, my staff tells me that indeed that was the case. And so the motion is proper before us. Representative Erickson, I do want to make sure that others have an opportunity to amend appropriately to the delete all, and so we'll work to make that happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we realize that the delete all by Representative Benson was on time. It's just that we can't know what's happening on our end to be able to appropriately provide some changes. So thank you. We'll talk about it offline.
I appreciate that, Representative Erickson, and it's a good reminder then for the chair to be flexible and making sure that we then act according to the members' wishes here in terms of acting on amendments. with that, Representative, all in favor of the A130116 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Erickson, Representative Benson, your bill is
thank
before
you, Mr.
us in the shape you want. Wish
thank,
it be.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I had asked for only 10 minutes, and I'm going to do my best to stay within that parameter. And so I will reduce some of my comments, but I have a few that I need to make here. First of all, former Representative Tom Tilbury would like to have very much been here today to testify as well, but was unable to do so. But I will have Walter Roberts, Professor Walter Roberts, who all of you are getting to know very well, who will have some comments. And by the way, he will be discussing only my delete all, not some of the other comments I'm going to make about this particular bill. So I want to make that clear to the committee. Also, this delete all now, or the bill, is supported by Education Minnesota, I've been advised. So first of all, we all know, especially for those of us who've been on a committee for a number of sessions, that this issue concerning the lack or the decline in state support for student services personnel has become a major issue in our state. Depending on whose surveys you look at, Minnesota ranks at or near the bottom, especially in consular services, and now because of, in my opinion, inadequate state funding for public education K through 12, we're having the same problem with school nurses, school psychologists, drug intervention counselors, and other essential support staff. And I feel I can say that they are support and essential support staff because I spent 35 years as a classroom teacher myself, and I know the great benefit to me and my teaching through the help of these support staff. This particular delete all solves one of the problems, Mr. Chair and, committee members, I was facing. As some of you know, I have been attempting over these last three terms that I've served to try to reduce and eliminate as many unfunded state mandates on our public schools as I could. It has been a daunting task and mostly unsuccessful, but I'm going to keep at it. And this delete all does take care of that problem because, Mr. Chairman, it is a totally voluntary bill and proposal. So that's one good aspect I think I've been able to move on. The objective of the bill is to increase the student support staff. And although this is not the Finance Committee, if fully funded to the degree I'm suggesting, it would add, depending on compensation for support staff individuals, it would provide between 500 and 800 support staff for our K-12 system in the state. And although that would not bring us to the point that I think we ought to be, it would be a major step forward. So it is not an unfunded mandate. It is a matching grant program. And the reason for that is I've noticed in my own experience as a teacher that when funds are provided by the state for a particular objective, often because of the pressure of finances for local districts, they sometimes will take the finances from an area that we are trying to support and put it in their general revenue and then use the money from the state simply to kind of fill the pot that they had before. And so the matching grant objective in this case is to put some skin in the game on the part of the school district. So it's a 50-50 match. So if the school districts come up with some money, then the state will match that. That's the objective. And it is totally based on local decision making. School districts can participate if they choose. They do not have to participate if they don't want to, and for whatever reason they don't want to or they do want. And it also allows them to mix as they choose. Some individual buildings, in fact, might see that they have a greater need for a drug intervention counselor, their need for a drug intervention counselor than another social psychologist or another social worker or another nurse or another counselor, or they may have some mix that they wish. And my view is that should be left to the local districts to decide. Now, there are some problems, of course, we know, having to do with funding. The department has met with me, including the Commissioner Casilius, about this. And so, Mr. Chair, I'm hoping that we can move this bill forward to the Education Finance Committee. And in the meantime, we can work on some of these issues having to do with finance and some of the concerns the department has about implementation. But I'm very anxious that we keep this before the public, before the legislature. It is, in my opinion, an embarrassment that the state of Minnesota is so far down on the list of states in providing these key items. But there are resources in the governor's budget that, as a sovereign branch of state government, our legislature might see fit to reallocate, or at least in some way, find the resources to finance this particular bill. For example, I was very interested in supporting Representative Dabney's bullying bill, and if you look at the text, there is discussion about support staff implementing his bill. So I'm hoping that Representative Dabney, when he quits presenting more and more bills, he'll have a moment to spend with me and maybe others, and we could come up with some language as an amendment, because I'm not on the K-12 Finance Committee. So there are other items I could mention, but I, because of time, I would like to turn this discussion over to Professor Roberts, who will talk about this specific bill as it's been amended, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You. Thank you, Representative Benson. Representative, or Mr. Roberts, we don't have a lot of time, but we're going to get back to the next bill, so we're not going to be able to act on this bill yet this morning. We'll finish it off this this evening, but if you can give us your wisdom in concise and precise terms, that would be wonderful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I will be brief. I am Walter Roberts. I'm Professor of Counselor Education at MSU Mankato, and I want to make it very clear, even though I had the opportunity to serve as co-chair of the Task Force with Bullying Prevention, I speak specifically related to the Delete All Amendment. I don't want to mix those two hats together. The Delete All Amendment that has been provided today, Representative Benson did a very good job of explaining exactly what the purpose is. The bill is straightforward, and you're going to hear me use this term opportunity. I'm going to use this as I move through some highlights of the bill. I want to make three points, and then I will summarize. First and foremost, as Representative Benson said, it is not an unfunded mandate. It's no mandate at all. A school can choose not to participate in this grant funding opportunity to increase its student services personnel. Second, it's an opportunity for school districts to keep and or improve their level of student services personnel that they have within their school, and hopefully in many instances it will be an opportunity for some schools to perhaps create their first total student services personnel team. This is a particularly of great importance in rural areas of our state where services for kids are quite limited. The third point I want to make is that it provides the opportunity to increase the effectiveness of our student services personnel teams where they currently exist. Is it a ratio bill? No. Does it recommend following the guidelines of the specific professions when it comes to managing their caseloads? Yes. That is because each profession knows the best caseload numbers that their personnel can manage, and I think that it is important that we give credence to that in terms of giving all student services personnel a fighting chance to be able to do their work. Representative Benson's bill is an effort to provide a model of more equitable funding among the student services personnel because as it often stands, the current funding mechanism is not always distributed equitably among the different student services personnel. So we hope that this could serve as a model to perhaps correct that. In closing, I'd like to say that we are spending a lot of well-deserved time in this session talking about students who are identified as in whenever they are, quote, in trouble. And clearly, that is an important aspect of what we should be doing. I believe, however, that increasing student services personnel across the board is an opportunity to reach more students before they get, quote, in trouble. We can reach them in the general student population. We can increase their level of academic success, their physical success, their mental health success, and I believe very strongly that that is a part of what we want to do within our schools, as well as, and I think this particular bill meets the criteria as set forth in the Delete All Amendment. So I thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I hope I made it under 4 minutes.
Thank you, Dr. Roberts. Very well done. Spectacularly done. Representative Benson, I'm going to lay, the chair's going to lay House File 363 over. We'll take this up after our recess this evening. And then we're going to pull up Representative Dabney's bill. Thank you, Dr. Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I saved 30 seconds for the committee.
Wonderful. Good. Representative Dabney, House File 771. The chair will lift that up from the table.
Thank
I think that's
chair.
A proper thing to say. And so the motion before us is to pass House File. Actually, your initial motion, but I think we're going to possibly change this. Initial motion is to lay over House File 771 for possible inclusion in the policy bill. But I think we're going to change that after this. Just send me a signal if I'm right or wrong. Representative Wills, you have an oral amendment to House File 771.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney and Lisa Larson and I discussed, and what we came up with is the following. Move to amend House File 771 as follows. On page 2, line 16, after accessible, insert in an electronic format on a school or district website, or make a paper copy available upon request describing, and then it would continue into the language here, a restrictive procedures plan, and so on.
Is that it? Very well. Members, do we understand the amendment before us, perhaps? We're going to repeat it again, but Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, I'd urge support for the amendment, and again commend Representative Wills for her diligence on this and clarifying language.
Very well. So Representative Wills moves an oral amendment. And Ms. Larson, I'm wondering if you can perhaps repeat the language before us again.
Mr. Chairman, members, per Representative Wills' oral amendment for House File 771 as follows. Page 2, line 16, after accessible, insert in an electronic format on a school or district website, or make a paper copy available upon request describing.
Very well. Questions, members? If not, all in favor of the Wills oral amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Wills. Representative Dabney, you have an appropriations
That's correct,
in this
Mr.
bill. It seems to me the wiser course for your bill is to move it to K-12 finance so that Representative Marquardt is at least on that committee's radar. I mean, we could certainly move it in a policy bill, but I kind of like having the idea of having that committee have as early awareness of possible appropriations as they go through their difficult deliberations. But I leave it to you, as the author of the bill, whether we should amend the motion or not.
Mr. Chair, I would encourage that House File 771 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. There is an appropriation. I think the concerns that the committee has brought forward today are, A, legitimate, but, B, point to the need for funding to assure students, teachers, other staff, and parents that the training is occurring and that resources are available to implement the sort of programming that would hopefully prevent as many of these uses of prone restraint and seclusion as possible and isolate them down to only emergency situations if we cannot eliminate them.
Very well. Members, are we ready to vote? Very well. Representative Dabney changes his motion, and the motion before us is to pass House File 771 as amended and have it re-referred to the House Committee on K-12 Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and thank you to the advocates who've made this possible.
Indeed. Members, hold on a quick second. Okay. Members, we're going to recess until 5 o'clock. We'll be back in this room. We'll finish the Benson bill, and then we have room 5. I'm told it's room 5 at 5 o'clock. We'll finish the two bills, and hopefully we won't be here too long. So still then, until then, this committee stands in recess. So the committee will come to order, and we'll pick up where we left off this morning. Representative Benson, House File 363. Representative Benson, we'll take your... we'll take your bill up off the table. And it's before us, and we had your testifier today. You may have other individuals to testify, but we are in your hands at this
point. I don't know. Why don't you ask to see if there is anyone? I did want it while we're waiting to see if anyone likes to testify. I want to give some credit too, to Professor Roberts. This alternative is really his creation. But I had the great genius to see what a great idea it was, Mr. Chair, without a moment of hesitation.
You uphold the honor of this committee well, Representative.
I could just summarize if you wish, unless there are other testifiers, I think we're pretty much finished.
We probably do want to wait for a few more members to show. I think we're at, are we at quorum yet? I mean, actually, we already have a quorum, but I want to make sure before we vote that we actually physically have a quorum in the room at that time. Okay, is there anyone else that wishes to testify on the bill for or against? Ms. Sandbeck.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Sandvig, and I'm here on behalf of the School Nurses Organization of Minnesota and Minnesota School Social Workers. And we would like to thank the author for the direction that he's going in this bill. Originally, the bill just included ratios for school counselors, and we really appreciate that he's looked at embracing the whole spectrum as far as pupil support services. We believe that each one of the disciplines comes with specific skills as far as providing support for students and teachers, and there's also overlap with that too. So we think it's important as far as looking for additional funding for those groups to be able to support students. We've certainly seen that with legislation that we've seen with school-linked mental health services. This committee heard presentations about kind of the continuum of services, and certainly there are services being provided in schools too. The Safe Schools for All legislation that Representative Dabney is carrying too is also an integral part of what pupil support services do. So we will continue to work with the author to find as far as looking at appropriate funding for those, and we appreciate the way that he has drafted that to look at basing it on the needs of students and schools as far as being able to put together their composition of pupil support teams. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Savick, and it's been a pleasure working with you this session to date. I think the concept before us is one that kind of evolved over time, and frankly, I'm Representative Benson, I'm awfully pleased that we're not plowing the same old roads that we have in the past in regards to some of our concerns with number of counselors in our state. I think you offer us a different approach here. Obviously, you've got a bill that's got a pretty sizable fiscal appropriation in it. I suspect the next committee, assuming that survives here, will struggle appropriately with it. But nonetheless, I think, at least from a policy perspective here, we've got a different approach to a problem that's vexed us for quite a while. And unfortunately, in our worst moments, it sort of pitted, friends against friends. And so thank you for coming up with a different approach here. Are there any questions before we vote for Representative Benson? Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Benson, I have a school in my district that... while it has a counselor, it uses a bunch of different options for services for students. Some of it is even, in fact, a lot of my school districts use the Northwest Mental Health Center. It's based out of Crookston, but it serves all the way up to the Canadian border in some school districts. I'm thinking that this works for them. Is that, will that work for alternative things rather than just school-related only? Because the mental health center deals with a lot of different constituents.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The qualifications I have really are dealing with whether they are licensed by the Board of Teaching and whether or not auxiliary resources like the one you're stating, I'm not sure. I hadn't thought of it in that sense. I was, I guess, thinking more of those who are hired and work for schools, school systems. So that might be something we could discuss. The objective of this is to allow local school districts a maximum of decision making at the local level. So that part of your question is intriguing to me because this legislation is designed to provide these grants so that school districts individually, even by billing, if the district so chooses, since it's totally voluntary, to use these funds. Whether or not they would be used to purchase services outside the district, I hadn't really considered that.
Representative Kiel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm thinking of things like contracting a drug counselor doesn't have an education degree. Social workers that come into the building. Sometimes the children are dealt with through social services / the school. So then there might be a social worker assigned to the family that would work in different areas and then partially work in the schools also. But I don't believe they would have a teacher's license or be, licensed by the Board of Teaching.
Well, if you'd look at subsection 4, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, 2.1 through 2.5 about, says the team members must serve within the scope and practice the established and recognized capacity of their respective professions and as defined by the Board of Teaching. So that's fairly prescriptive in that regard.
Right. So then, they could not apply for, the grant wouldn't apply to, I mean, if they are not defined by the Board of Teaching and then they wouldn't be able to apply for the grant.
I don't believe so.
Representative Bison, Mr. Chair. Representative Breiter, I believe, to this point.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiel, the kinds of circumstances you're describing, I think others who serve on the Early Childhood Committee might recognize as situations in which school-based mental health grants, which there is a bill moving forward in that area, those would be funds that would support that type of personnel you're talking about that aren't licensed educators but deliver mental health services within the school setting.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Benson.
In fact, now that Representative Reiner mentions that, I am also carrying a bill. It's actually a bonding bill for a private school, which has now turned its properties over to Hennepin County. And we're seeking bonding, and they provide a whole range of services to schools in the community, and they are not part of any school district. So these kinds of things have happened. This particular bill doesn't address it, though.
Representative Roger Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think to Representative Keel's question with other mental health services outside, I believe the
the school would be more in a identify the student, identify the need, find that correct vehicle. If it's outside the school, then it would, you know, that would be outside. I know in my little school we have brick services, you know, that come in and take care of those students, and I think that's, I think the direction that the bill is intending to go. Is that correct?
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, again, the scope of this particular bill was directed mostly at the lack of student support services that districts have been facing. Those other issues, there are a number of programs and funding sources that I think are utilized and can be utilized for that kind of activity, but it isn't included particularly in this bill.
Very well. Are there any further questions? If not, then Representative Benson Manuza's motion that House File 363, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance.
Yes.
All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roger Erickson, I think we might just make those hockey games tonight.
You got tickets?
I wish. Okay, Representative Morgan, House File 1003. And Representative Morgan, I believe you have a motion for us.
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I would like to move that House File 1003 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Education Finance, K-12 Finance Committee.
Very well. Representative Morgan moves adoption of House File 1003 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, one of our focuses in the Education Committees this year is to continue or begin or improve the way we're closing the achievement gap. I think we'll all agree that there is no silver bullet. It's going to take a lot of levers, pushing on a lot of different levers to get us moving in the right direction towards a 21st century workforce. I think this bill, 1003 today, the formation of Minnesota Math Corps, will help be one of those levers. I have some folks here who are going to talk about the successes of the Minnesota Reading Corps and successes of the Minnesota Math Corps and how expanding on those successes can help students achieve closing the achievement gap, improving proficiency in math skills that will help to build the workforce we need as we move forward to improve our economy. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Sheila Pipo, Executive Director of the Serve Minnesota Action Network, who can talk about the Math Corps Network.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Pipo. Did I pronounce that correct?
Close.
Pipo.
Yes.
Very well. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Sheila Pipo. I am the Executive Director of the Serve Minnesota Action Network. Our organization implements three AmeriCorps programs, the Reading Corps, the Math Corps, and the Opportunity Corps. And as a point of reference, AmeriCorps programs are often thought of as the Domestic Peace Corps. We are delighted and grateful for the opportunity to provide testimony today on the Minnesota Math Corps. It is a statewide initiative that is now in its fifth year. The objective of the program is to ensure that Minnesota students are achieving proficiency in math by the end of eighth grade, specifically algebra, because research tells us that algebra is a critical gateway course. It correlates with the completion of high school. It also correlates with the entrance and completion of post-secondary education, which is very important for our state. Math Corps started in the St. Cloud School District in 2008. The district at that time was concerned with the growing achievement, the achievement gap, and it had strong support from the Reading Corps, and it had the desire to create a similar program that would help address the deep needs of math that the district was seeing. Following the program model that Reading Corps had designed, Math Corps combines the people power of AmeriCorps with the science on how students learn math. during our testimony, we're going to be showing a short 3-minute video that really gives you the day-to-day, gives you a look into the day-to-day program delivery of MathCorps. You'll also be able to hear from Melissa Sonic, an instructional coach in the Maplewood, North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale schools, and she works with one of our members on a daily basis and has experienced the impact of MathCorps within her school. So we will start out with the video.
There may be a sound issue here.
Anybody has any brilliant ideas?
Addie has missed a significant amount of school because she has had some health problems.
So we're going to start a new lesson today.
Okay. And there were so many pieces missing that she just wasn't understanding math.
This, which is across from the right angle, is called the hypotenuse.
Okay. If I could tell someone about MathCorps, the thing that I would tell them is if they have a student that's struggling, MathCorps is such an amazing experience for them.
MathCorps serves the students that are below meeting our Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment. And what it does for those kids is it keeps that gap from widening, keeps them from falling further behind.
If you are a committed educator and you want to make sure kids are proficient, it's good to have a good, solid program to make sure that kids are getting the information they need to become successful in life. MathCorps gives you that tool.
I don't know of other systems that are designed as well as this and getting as many results.
I want to know the equation in standard form of the line that goes through both.
It was frustrating because I was like, I didn't know half the stuff that they were doing and I didn't understand what they were doing.
She would come home and, Mom, I don't get it. But knowing that she's going to MathCorps and she's got those extra days, today's a MathCorps day. If I don't get this, I can go there and ask.
Addie's did amazing. As an internal coach, when I meet with a tutor like Becky, we sit down and we look at progress. You know, where did Addie start? Where is she now?
Going back to our triangle.
When our tutors start working with a student, one of the first things they do is they look at the data about that student, their Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment score from the previous spring, and their measures of academic progress test that they take 3 times a year. So all their decisions on what they teach the kids is based on that data.
So we're looking at fall to winter. Mm-hmm. So fall score, 225. Winter score, 243, there's not room for it.
Because she's actually off the charts.
So we are currently in point slope form. Where are we going next?
It just felt like I was stupid almost, but now I feel confident.
Addie, where are we going next?
Addie wants to be a pediatric nurse when she grows up. Math and science is what she needs to have with nursing. It helps them gain their confidence. It helps them raise their test scores. It helps them just become a better person.
There's a lot of Addies out there. There are a lot of kids who maybe nobody believed in and nobody has given them the opportunity to really excel. And by giving them just this little step up, we're really helping them take a bunch of steps on their own.
I think MathCorps is a very essential part of an academic and instructional program that you have at your school.
In my history, and I've been in education for a long time, it's one of the most exciting strategies I have ever seen because it works so well.
So that just gives you a quick overview of MathCorps. Now, if you want to look at the handouts that you have, the after the first slide, there is one that describes the member's activities. And as described in the video, students come to us if they are partially proficient on the previous spring's MCA, and then they receive tutoring sessions at least 90 minutes a week, and they're tutored in pairs. And math lends itself really well to peer learning from each other, so the students really respond well to that type of model. We also know that successful interventions require student-specific data that identify where the learning holes are for that particular student. And the MCA data, the state assessment, and then the measures of academic progress provide us with really rich data to be able to figure out what it is that the student needs to get back on track with their math proficiency. We also have diagnostic assessments within the curriculum that we use that help us pinpoint those skills even further. So we know that a student may be struggling in the area of geometry, but what is it about geometry? So that's where we target our services. We also conduct frequent progress monitoring to ensure that students are grasping the concepts. So we want to make sure that the students understand it this time and it doesn't continue to be a gap for them. We can move at a pace that's right for the pair, which is very beneficial. Then on the next slide, we talk about our evidence-based approach. So we use a very specific intervention curriculum, and it's highly scripted. It's explicit instruction with scaffolding, which is really important because we're working with individuals who are very bright in math, but they may not necessarily have a teaching background. So this gives them the tools they need to make that tutoring effective. We also have the ability to use manipulatives during those tutoring sessions, and that's what makes the math come alive for the students. So they're using base 10 blocks, they're using fraction circles, they're using cylinders and cubes. That's sometimes what they've missed. They haven't been able to see the math in a three-dimensional way, and that helps them make the connections a lot easier. The model is structured in a way that allows licensed teachers to act as internal coaches, such as Melissa, to analyze the student-specific data. So we're always paying attention to how the students are progressing and if we have to slow down or if we can speed up in a certain area. Often the needs are great, particularly when we're starting to look into the 7th and 8th graders because they've had holes in their mathematics knowledge dating back several years. So those students often take, we see them in math work for a full year and maybe even into the next year. What the results are that we've seen, so in 2011-2012, we are the most proud of the growth that students saw. So we measure that by looking at the measures of academic progress, otherwise known as the MAP test, and over 73% of our students met or exceeded the nationally normed growth rates. This was an increase of nearly 10% over the previous year. And in our first 3 years, MathCorps has ensured that 613 students have met that gold standard of passing that 8th grade MCA, which is so critical for all of us. And then finally, as we've grown this program, we've definitely found that we haven't been able to keep up with the demand. The chart the pie charts show that what the demand was like in 2012 and 13. So we were able to put 109 AmeriCorps members into schools, but schools had requested 318. And we were able to get AmeriCorps members into 90 schools, but there were 201 schools that had requested members. We had to say no to over 110 schools. That demand continues to follow us into the 13-14 school year. We just made awards in the last couple of weeks, and we awarded 200 members. Schools had requested 353, and the number of schools had also been increasing. We saw requests from 232 schools across the state, and we were able to get into 195 of them. So I'm now going to turn it over to Melissa Sonnet, who will give you what the program looks like on a day-to-day basis from her perspective at Carver Elementary.
Thank you. Good evening, Ms. Sonic. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
All right. Greetings, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Melissa Sonic, and I am an instructional coach at Carver Elementary School in Independent School District 622. I'm also an internal coach for both Math Corps and Reading Corps. And I'm here tonight to tell you our story and the partnership that we have between Math Corps and Carver School. So how does Math Corps fit in at Carver? It fits into a structure and a system that we call Response to Intervention, otherwise known as RTI. RTI is a multi-tiered approach at helping struggling readers, our struggling learners. And it starts really with that tier one, and that's powerful classroom instruction. That it begins with a viable and guaranteed curriculum, but also effective teaching. Teachers knowing that they need to differentiate for their students. That can look like whole group instruction, small group, conferring one-to-one, reteaching, pre-teaching. I like to call it teaching with your hair on fire, because that's kind of what it feels like. For our students, about 80% of our students will respond to those strategies. But I also know that children take different paths to common outcomes, and some of our kids need more. And that's where our Tier 2 intervention comes into play. Now, Tier 2 intervention has three characteristics that sets it apart from Tier 1. It's evidence-based, it's small group instruction, it's implemented with fidelity, and most importantly, it's done in addition to what's happening in that Tier 1 instruction. It's giving our children multiple opportunities for success. 15% of students usually respond to these strategies, and that's where Math Corps fits in. Currently, we have 24 students at Carver being served in Math Corps, 14 fourth graders, and 10 fifth graders. So I want to move on to talk about data. I hear you like data here, right? Well, me too. So if you go to, in your handout, it's a document that looks like this. I'll tell you the story of our data. Last year was our first year with Math Corps, and as a site, Carver went up 4% in our math proficiency. Our proficiency in math in fourth grade went up 5.3%, and our proficiency in math in fifth grade went up 2.2%. I'd like to share one student's story, an 11-year-old fourth grade girl who is an English language learner and also qualifies for free and reduced price lunch. In the spring of 2011, she scored a 188 on her math test. After a year in Minnesota Reading Corps, she scored 219 on her math test. That's a 21-point gain, which is phenomenal. But part of what also means a lot was her story. When I asked her to tell me about Math Corps, these were her words, and you have to forgive me for slipping into a 10-year-old girl's vernacular here. The stuff I did with Abdi, that was her member, made what we were doing in class easier because he showed us how to do it with, like, cubes and blocks and this rectangle map thing. He just made it make sense for me. And this year math is easy because I remember all the stuff he taught me last year. I like math because now I'm good at it. So that's one student, but what about the rest of our students, right? 50% of the students served in Math Corps went from partially meeting standards to meeting standards. Two-thirds of the students in Math Corps hit their growth targets, as evidenced by math. This means our hardest to teach kids are beating the odds. Normally, with our hardest to teach students, about 20% or so move quartiles. So Math Corps moving 50% is incredible. And in closing, I just want to touch on why is that important. And this is probably what you already know, but students who don't meet state standards are more likely to live a life of poverty. Students who do meet state standards are more likely to graduate. Students who do meet state standards are more likely to go on to post-secondary education. When we move students from partially meets into that meeting category, we are, in essence, changing their stars. We are changing the trajectory of a child's life. As partners, Minnesota Math Corps and Carver Elementary School are working to close that achievement and opportunity gap to really give our kids the life that they deserve. And in closing, as an educator, you know, I want to live a life that benefits others. That's what this work is all about. And saying that the partnership between Math Corps and our schools has benefited our children would be an understatement. It's really, truly changing the trajectory of our children's lives.
Thank you, Ms. Sonic.
Thank you.
Representative Morgan?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, as you can see, I'm really glad we actually got postponed to later on today, because otherwise Ms. Sonic wouldn't have been here to tell that story, and I think it's a great one, and she tells it well. Again, there are no silver bullets, members, but you can see when alongside excellent classroom instruction from licensed teachers who know their work and are experienced in the classroom, this tool can really move the needle. And I think it's a good policy, and I think we should pass it along to the Finance Committee and see what we can do as far as spending some money on this. So I urge your support, members, and I think we're ready to answer any questions you have.
And we do have some questions, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I recognize this isn't the Finance Committee, but how much money you have does, I think, determine how many AmeriCorps members you get to deploy into the schools, whether it's Carver or my own Minneapolis schools, where I know Reading Corps has been a real plus, and Math Corps as well. The federal government is a part of the equation here as well, and sequestration, none of the committees that I'm on here have really looked at the impact of sequestration on our schools, and I know it varies across the state from school district to school district, but can you speak to the impact of sequestration on the AmeriCorps program, please?
Ms. People.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Dabney. What we know about sequestration right now, it doesn't impact our current program years. We're able to continue that. And what we know for next year, there will be a cut to AmeriCorps programming, a 5.5% cut. And we expect that we will still be able to maintain a $2.5 million AmeriCorps program funding. So we expect that instead of 200 members, Math Corps would be impacted by losing about 9 members. So we would still be at 191.
All right. So, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So 5% cut? Is that how my... Somebody from Math Corps is the right person to ask that question, yeah. I guess. Okay, at that point, I'm going to stop. Well, I'm maybe not ahead, but not getting further behind, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
As you do damage to the bill. Are there any further questions? Is there anyone in the audience that has testimony? Representative Wells has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. And I'm curious on the training. And I know it was mentioned a little bit on the training that is for the volunteers who would be giving this this extra help to the students. What kind of training is there? How thorough is it? How is it maybe different than what teachers do?
There's people.
Yes. We provide thorough training to our members. So before they start their service in the schools, they receive a week-long training with us, with what we call master coaches. So those are individuals who are experts in math curriculum and instruction. So they get a week-long training with us, and also the curriculum, again, is really scripted, so people are able to follow that. It gives them ideas of, like, if a student is answering a question wrong, like why they may be and where it is that they're going astray. So that's helpful for individuals who may not have a teaching background. The members also receive ongoing coaching, so they have the internal coach like Melissa who's available to them on a daily basis. And then they also have master coaches that are providing additional support who see them on about a monthly or bi-monthly basis.
Other questions? Representative Keels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I noticed the program goes, is it through eighth grade? Is that right?
Ms. People.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Representative Keels.
And you said you do RTI, response to intervention, for those who don't know. But response to intervention, do you do that through grade school and through, I mean, all the way through eighth grade with that? Or... When you're working with the students, do you do response to intervention through all the way through eighth grade?
Yes, we do. We work with the schools, and we're looking at how Math Corps fits into each individual school and what they've got on there, how they do their math curriculum, how they do their instruction, and we are able to provide that the services to the partially proficient students. We're part of an RTI model that a school may be implementing.
Representative Kim.
So, you know, this. I know the Reading Corps group is, that's a good good program, and response to intervention is great. The school that I was a school board member on did response to intervention all the way through high school. What my question is how are the high school students that have been in this program, how are they doing academically now, and how long have you done this program?
Yes, people.
We started the program in 2008 in St. Cloud. So we're just starting to see some of it, like most of our focus starts in that fourth, fifth, sixth grade. So we're now starting to see the students in the seventh and or into the high school. And we haven't done a lot of longitudinal studies to see if the tutoring is holding. But we do have the ability to be able to go back with the St. Cloud schools and figure that out.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? I want to thank you for your testimony, both of you. I'm familiar with the Reading Corps. I've been here long enough that I remember it was Representative Segrin at the time, who chaired our finance committee at the time, was on her committee, authored that bill and got state investment into Minnesota Reading Corps. And then, obviously, as commissioner, continued to support the program. Over the years, I've had the privilege to carry some bills for the Minnesota Reading Corps as well. I think it's a great match with the AmeriCorps, federal program to unleash these young people throughout the state of Minnesota. I think it's literally, it's got to be at least hundreds.
Yes.
Of AmeriCorps members all over the state. So it sounds like you're delivering the program pretty much the same as, with the tenets of the Reading Corps. I've noticed that you've had some growth. This is not the Finance Committee, but I'm just dying to know. I'll ask it in Finance, assuming the bill moves forward. But obviously, you've been able to grow the program a little bit without state funding. What's made it possible to do that? And obviously, with state funding, you're probably looking to really, bring this, throughout the state. But what's been the supportive element to make it grow up to this point without state funding?
Mr. Chair, we have, up to this point, MathCorps has been able to benefit from the formula funding that the Serve Minnesota, the State Commission, receives for AmeriCorps funding. So that's where we've been able to, that's how we've been able to grow slightly. But this additional state funding will definitely be able to reach much deeper into the state and double in size rather than growing by maybe 25 or 50.
Very well. Any other questions, members? If not, then Representative Morgan renews his motion that House File 1003 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Morgan.
Thank you.
Ms. Sonic, Ms. People. Members, we're going to adjourn shortly here. We're going to meet tomorrow morning at 8:30. And what room are we in? Oh, right here in front of me. 8:30 tomorrow morning in our regular hearing room in the basement hearing room. We'll be hearing MTLE issues, teacher licensure issues, as well as student testing issues related to the grad and others. I think we've got three bills teed up. Don't hold me to that. Should be a good discussion. These are big bills, so bring your thinking caps. After you watch the hockey game tonight, we'll straight the bed so that you come prepared for a good conversation. So with that, if there are any questions, we stand adjourned until tomorrow.